Bristol. Bristol. Community FM. 93.2.
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. It started this week, but why does it take a foreign TV channel to give Julian Assange his own talk show? And police are balloting over the right to strike, the biggest attempt to change their paying conditions for 30 years. Kevin Phillips is here from a local police federation to explain why. And with all the changes to the education system, what's this meaning for young mums? Claire Humphreys is along from the Local Schools for Local Children campaign to share with us the dilemmas of the modern mum. And also, Black Avon and Somerset police officer turned driving instructor Phil Mattis has written a book about the state of the family in 21st century Bristol. He joins me to explain why he left the police and what prompted him to write the book. But first, Martin Summers is here for our weekly reconnaissance tour across world politics. Now, Martin, to begin with, we've had this new programme on the English-speaking channel on Freeview, Russia Today, with Julian Assange. Why is it, do you think, that it's taken actually a Russian channel to do this? Even though Assange is under house arrest, there's nothing to stop a British channel doing the same.
Well, I mean, there's the politics of it, isn't it? I mean, what's happening in international TV is that everybody has now got an English-language TV flagship station. So Russia Today is funded by the Russian Parliament. And they are basically picking up the voices in the West that the West doesn't want to hear, just as BBC picks up the voices in Russia that the Russians don't want to hear. I noticed we've got Pussy Riot as a potential story later.
Well, who are they, Pussy Riot?
Pussy Riot are a punk band, which have feminist punk band, which have recently tried to do a kind of an impromptu gig in the Orthodox Cathedral in Russia, and they sang a song called Holy SH1T, attacking Putin and what have you. And that's not the sort of thing that Russia Today wants to encourage, so they do cover it, but in a rather negative way. Just as in this country, demonstrations by our people are covered in a rather snooty way by the BBC, but the Russians are quite keen on them. And what's happening is competition at the international level for quality English language broadcasting, and in a way that's good.
Now, one of the things that we've had discussed on here, particularly with Anthony J. Hall, who wrote this book, Earth into Property, is that actually the media are in the driving seat. Quite often they're more powerful than our elected governments.
Well, the media are the crucial link between ordinary people and what goes on, aren't they? People's opinions are formed by what they read and hear and what their friends tell them. So obviously,
And what they don't hear.
So obviously, everybody's recognised that that's the game. So you've got Press TV, which is Iranian version of the BBC.
Well, you haven't anymore, have you? Because they've actually been banned from Sky now.
They have been banned, but that just goes to show that they're obviously annoying somebody, doesn't it?
Anyway, let's have a listen now to a little excerpt from the inaugural episode of this programme on Russia Today with Julian Assange.
I'm Julian Assange, editor of WikiLeaks. We've exposed the world's secrets.
These documents belong to the United States government.
Been attacked by the powerful.
The United States strongly condemns.
Hey, quit asking questions.
He broke the law.
Illegally shoot the son of a...
For 500 days now, I've been detained without charge. But that hasn't stopped us. Today, we're on a quest for revolutionary ideas that can change the world tomorrow. I want to know, why is he called a freedom fighter by millions, and at the same time a terrorist by millions of others? This is his first interview in the West since the 2006 Israel-Lebanon war. His party, Hezbollah, is a member of the Lebanese government. He is its leader, Saeed Hassan Nasrallah. Israel says that
Israel تقول
Hezbollah has fired rockets into Israel
Hezbollah
at civilian areas. Is that true?
Throughout the past years, even since 1948, when the State of Israel was created on the land of Palestine, Israeli forces have been shelling civilians, Lebanese civilians, the Lebanese towns and Lebanese villages. In the resistance years, that's between 1982 until 92, after 10 years of resistance, we started reacting, but purely and only and strictly to stop Israel shelling our civilians. So in 1993, there was an understanding. It was indirect between the resistance and Israel, and that understanding was reaffirmed in 1996. And that understanding makes clear that both sides avoid shelling civilians. And we always used to say, if you don't shell our villages and towns, then we have nothing to do with your villages and your towns. So this method, Hezbollah resorted to it after long years of aggression against Lebanese civilians, and its aim is purely to make a kind of deterrent balance to prevent Israel from killing Lebanese civilians.
That was Saeed Nasrallah from Hezbollah there. Apparently the first interview for many years on Western TV. Martin, why
it's
has it been...
on Western TV, it's on Russia Today.
So well, he's saying Russia is actually part of the West. That's what he's saying.
Okay.
And that's what the way he introduced it. Anyway,
China.
I suppose Russia is kind of half and half, isn't it, really? He's talking about the quest for revolutionary ideas. Isn't there something sort of a little bit dangerous about this? It's almost like he's trying to find out the most revolutionary people anywhere on Earth and give them airtime.
No, listen. I mean, listening to Hassan Nasrallah like that, the reason why Western TV stations don't interview him is because he's a very reasonable guy. I mean, we had a Hezbollah spokesperson come to talk in Bristol Council House, and somebody made a fuss about it. And when he got up, he spoke in a very reasonable way about what their grievances are, what their goals are, and so on. As I said, he's an elected member of the Lebanese government, and that's just the way of it. If you don't want to listen to people you don't agree with, then you're never going to solve anything, are you?
So that programme is on every Tuesday now on RT, on the Russian to the Russia Today channel, on Freeview and on other services too. Now to China, and this is really a week or so old, this story, but Bo Xilai has been arrested, hasn't he, Martin?
Yeah,
he hasn't been arrested. He's been kicked out of the Politburo. His wife's been arrested.
Yeah, and there's also this murder of this British businessman associated with it. I must admit, this is really like... trying to find a dark cat in a black cat in a dark room, which is hard, especially if it's not there. You know, trying to work out what's going on in Chinese politics.
Well, let's ask someone else there, Martin. And this is Paul, this is Newsnight's economics editor Paul Mason, who does know a little bit about the various factions within the Chinese Politburo.
I've got some ideas about it.
In November, British businessman Neil Haywood was found dead in a hotel room in China. The wife of probably the third most powerful politician in China has been charged with his murder, and that third most powerful politician, Mr. Bo Xilai, the boss of the city of Chongqing, has been sacked from the Politburo. So, regardless of what the rights and wrongs of the actual murder investigation, we have now got the situation of a power struggle at the very heart of the Communist Party of the second most powerful country in the world. We know for many years there's been two factions of the Chinese Communist Party, the pro-market one and a more social democratic one, which is allied to a so-called Maoist left, of which Mr. Bo Xilai is the leading example. What he did was not be part of this faction struggle that's been going on for years. He stepped out of the rules. The rules were you never appear over the heads of the party to the masses. Mr. Bo had for years been appealing to the masses in Chongqing, using rhetoric from the Cultural Revolution. He has some websites and some bookstores that support him. Four of those websites now closed down. I visited that bookstore, very rhetorically Maoist, 2 years ago. But now, under pressure. The problem is, anybody who knows about Stalinist purges, this is a classic purge. The problem is, we don't know how these things end in the modern world. How do they end?
Well, how do they end? I think he pretty much sums up the politics behind it. You've got two major factions in the Communist Party. One is a more pro-market, one a less pro-market faction. And of course, in the fullness of time, you could see those evolving into two democratic parties in China, which might contest elections against each other. So that might be the positive outcome of this kind of struggle. But as things stand at the moment, there's no way of bringing the people in. It's all settled behind closed doors by skullduggery, and that is the problem.
Well, also, the pro-market faction is sort of mirroring this change in the Politburo by now talking about going down the road of privatising their banking system.
Absolutely nuts. And it may well be that British intelligence and US intelligence are involved in this power struggle as well. Don't just presume it's a Chinese matter.
So he talked about the idea of a purge there. Where do you think it's going to end, Martin?
Well, when Gorbachev got rid of all of the old guard in the Soviet Union, he pensioned them off. And that was a step forward. Because if people are just pensioned off, it's not the same as shooting them in the head and sending their children to prison camps, is it? And one would hope that China will evolve into a civilised country. It's very clever, a lot of clever people there. They've done very well economically in recent years. But if you can't stand from the outside and say that you should just have free market free-for-all, that's just silly. The Chinese Communist Party have been quite smart about not getting involved in all the mess that we're involved in.
But how do you square this circle between the Chinese Communist Party being pro-market?
It's perfectly logical. I mean, in actual fact, in the real world, the free market works for some things and the state works for other things. Like, we've got the police. We're going to talk about the police in a minute. I don't think the police should be run by the private sector, and I don't think the Chinese police should be either. And that is the same in every country. There's going to be an argument about where that line is drawn, and that's perfectly logical and natural. The question is, how is the question resolved? Is it resolved peacefully? Is it resolved democratically? Is it resolved through force?
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now, the police are balloting over the right to strike and the biggest attempt to change their paying conditions for 30 years. And I'm joined by Kevin Phillips from the Local Police Federation to explain why. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony. How are you doing?
Tell me, first of all, what is the Police Federation?
Well, the Police Federation is effectively a staff association that looks after the welfare and well-being of their members. It is not a trade union. We do not have industrial rights, so therefore we cannot strike.
But I mean, are there other things that the Police Federation can lobby for? Is it all got to be done by agreement, or do you have any kind of industrial muscle?
What we eventually do in everything that we deal with is it's all through negotiation. We have to negotiate. Many people actually call us a toothless tiger. We're not, because we're actually quite good at negotiating. That is part and parcel of what we do.
So are all officers, all police officers and the senior ranks, all part of the Federation?
No, the Police Federation basically covers up to the rank of Chief Inspector. So it covers all federated ranks. And after that, there would be the Superintendents Association, ACPO, which is the Association of Chief Police Officers, and that's where it goes from there.
Okay, so what's this ballot about?
Well, effectively, and it takes us back right to the beginning and the formation of this coalition government. Clearly, the government have come in. They've come in with lots of money to save. And we started off with the comprehensive spending reviews, which have effectively taken 20% of the policing budget over the next 4 years from Avon and Somerset. On top of that, Avon and Somerset is subject to what is called a dampening effect, where an extra amount of money is taken away from us because we are seen as one of the rich partners, shall we say, and given to the other forces. So we have lost a lot of money. You know, we are looking at £40 million over the next 4 years.
Well, that's £10 million a year by my calculation, Martin. Can you just put this into context? Because I know that you think that these cuts aren't even actually necessary.
Well, that's the wider question. I mean, should you be cutting anything at this moment is a question that I would raise. And especially if you're going to cut everything else, why would you cut the police force? Because you're going to need them to deal with the consequences of what you're cutting, aren't you?
Well, one of the things, for example,
can
which happened...
Can I just ask a question? Is this ballot just in Avon and Somerset, or is it right across the country?
No, this is going to be a national ballot. I was going to come on to that, but effectively, just touching back on the cuts, what these cuts will cause across the country is a loss of 16,000 police officers. In this force alone, we are looking at losing approximately 700 police officers in the next 4 years. We are going to be going back to the 1980s level of policing, and that cannot be acceptable.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I don't think the cuts are necessary anyway, but let's just say for the sake of argument they are. That means that the poorest communities are going to be in crisis, and they're going to need their police officers, aren't they, to help them through it.
Absolutely. I think we saw it last summer with the disorder that happened throughout the summer.
Yeah.
It's, you know, It's not by coincidence. That was created because of what was going on. Who was there? The police turned up to deal with it. One of the classic quotes that came through the media last summer was the fact that 16,000 police officers were drafted into the metropolitan area to cover the riots in London. That is 16,000 police officers that we are looking at losing throughout the country.
Martin, can you just tell us in a nutshell why you don't think that the cuts are necessary?
Because the cuts are actually pushing the economy further down. The European Central Bank has got it wrong.
I mean, the thing is it will increase the deficit, won't it? Which is surely something we don't want to do.
But this will be the killer of all of this, is that by cutting, what you actually do is increase the deficit. They're supposed to be reducing the deficit, but as the economy goes down, the deficit will increase. The deficit in Britain is increasing as we speak. And the policy, frankly, is irrational. But leaving that aside, let's presume you did want to try and pursue a cuts policy. I mean, I remember the 1980s, and the first thing that the Thatcher government did was recruit a lot more police officers and give them a big pay rise, because they knew that there was going to be trouble.
Absolutely.
I think that we should have enough police officers to assure that there isn't any trouble. We don't want police officers to put down the trouble when it started. We don't want it to start in the first place, because the relationships have been built, and you know, you've got 700 police officers who must have built relationships in local communities, and that's all going to go. That's throwing away gold.
No, you're absolutely right. And I think the issue is, you know, we are going to lose those police officers. They will not be replaced. It's all going through natural wastage, because clearly police officers cannot be made redundant. That will change with the Windsor reviews, the reviews that this government have brought in to change the terms and conditions of police officers.
So can you tell us in a nutshell then what way they're proposing to change those terms and conditions? Obviously, anybody that is planning for a future career is planning on the basis that their terms and conditions are going to continue as they are, and that the contract's going to be honoured. But it sounds to me now as if the goalposts are shifting for police officers.
I think for police officers, over the last couple of years, we've been under constant attack from this government. We've been hit with pensions, which we accept. Not everybody agrees with why these things are there, why the pensions are there, but we've been hit with that. We've been hit with the Windsor reforms. This government brought in, Theresa May brought in Tom Windsor, former rail regulator, to actually do a review on the terms and conditions of policing. We are not against having a review of what we do. We, in fact, have asked for a Royal Commission on policing to look at what we actually do. But the way it's going at the moment, on Windsor 2, which came out recently, at the beginning of the year, it has given the power to chief constables to effectively make police officers redundant. Once we go down that line, police officers then become employees. Therefore, they should have the right to industrial rights.
But surely, I mean, the police are going to have to suffer in the same way as everybody else across society. If there's going to be cuts, then obviously some police officers are going to have to be made redundant.
We go down the route of, you had the HMIC report that said the police could...
That's Her Majesty's Inspector of Constabularies.
That's correct, sorry. Who proposed a 12% cut. The Labour government have proposed a 12% cut and said that policing can survive on that. This government came in with a 20% cut. They've also said it will not affect frontline policing. The face of policing. It will affect frontline policing. Whatever happens, if you take 20% of police officers out of this organisation, you will lose on the front line.
Martin, I mean, this isn't atypical for a Conservative government, isn't it? The Conservative government is often seen as being the party of law and order, and also of boosting the police, if not, you know, even as you said back in the 1980s, increasing pay.
Well, I think that's right, but I think things have moved on since the 1980s. I think the police service has changed out of all recognition in those years, and is very much valued by poor communities in particular, in a way, you know, that perhaps wasn't the case in the 80s. You know, there was definitely an us and them feeling. I used to live in Brixton, I remember it. And I think that it's one of the safety cushions for a society when it's going through a crisis, is that you've got a well-funded, efficient police force which isn't there to repress people. It's there to nip problems in the bud, because it's well dug in the local communities that it knows and serves. And to throw that away, to my mind, is absolutely insane. But the fact is that people running the show are ideological. You know, they just haven't got. You know, they haven't run anything very much.
So what's the ideal, Martin, here then? If they're ideological, I mean, I hear this.
What they're ultimately looking for is gated communities looked after by private police forces, and let's throw the poor communities to the dogs. I mean, in East Kansas, the police only go in on every second day because they're running out of money. And of course, the people who don't live in that community, they just don't care about that. And that's where we could go, where we don't have a uniform policing across the whole society. Some places become no-go areas effectively, and so on. And for those who live in the cushy areas, that's all right. But it's not all right. It's wrong.
What about this whole business of private policing? This is something we've heard recently, Kevin, building private companies. I think it was Tesco's building a police station, and also the role of the private security firms taking over from the police.
I think you're going to start going down that route. I mean, the first thing is that I actually believe that this government is trying to create a two-tier policing system. We are looking at using, for example, community support officers to actually be out there walking about in the streets.
They're doing that anyway, aren't they?
Exactly. And that obviously came out from South Yorkshire last week. I think it was a bit of a red herring, to be honest with you, because we've had them for years. They don't have warranted powers, they don't deal with violent situations, and they cannot arrest anybody.
So what's the problem with having a two-tier policing? That is almost like the soft touch and the hard touch.
And I think you've touched the words there perfectly, the hard touch. That means the police service that we've known since it was created, that is, you know, looked up to throughout the world. We are then going to become a paramilitary police service. We are only going to be dealing with violent confrontations, situations like that. We are not going to be out there in the community speaking to the people.
I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, when you look at all the work that's gone in Northern Ireland over the last 30 years to get the police accepted on all sides of the community, would they dare throw the same sort of nonsense in their direction? I doubt very much they would dare to think of it. And, you know, I think that there's something really positive that can come out of this. If the police stand and fight their corner, the rest of society can get behind you, because you are fighting our corner by fighting your corner.
So what's the difference, though, between, you know, actually being active and intervening beforehand? Surely, I mean, it's, you know, a lot of people don't want the police to be too intrusive. Surely you've got to wait until crime happens and develops before you can really intervene.
I think if you actually look at the crime figures, if you're actually proactive and going out there preventing the crime, you're actually addressing the issues beforehand with the communities, then the crime goes down. It's just that is a fact.
Okay, and on this ballot business, I mean, is it possible in the future that we may see some kind of strike action by the police? I know you've said already that the Federation is not allowed to strike.
I think gave a speech to somebody at the weekend, and as I said to those people present there, I never believed in my working life as a police officer I would be looking for industrial rights. I am so incensed by what this government is doing to the police service. I think we have to have that power. We need that. This government has chosen to take the police service on, and they're certainly making a good job of it.
Martin, it sounds like a bit of a battle, doesn't it, going on between, you know, what we're talking about really is this cabinet of millionaires and our police service, which upholds the law across the country.
And also they get to see the deprivation and the poverty, which some of these politicians never come across in their whole lives. I think it would be very, very dangerous for the police to go on strike, because the consequences could be very, very unfortunate. But I think you should have that in your locker as required. But I think also we should be lobbying the government to just back off on this.
But I mean, surely this isn't Cameron going to be hoisted by his own petard here? Surely this whole idea of cutting these rights for the police is going to backfire on him.
Well, one would hope so, and it requires the people in the comfortable parts of the country and in the less comfortable parts of the country to come together and tell them that it's not on.
Okay, Kevin, if you could just sum up, what is your, you know, if you were Home Secretary, what would you like to see happening right now?
I think if I was Home Secretary, we should be speaking to the police service. We should be working with the police service to get the police service that we should have. As I said earlier on, we are looked up to around the world. Everybody thinks that we have the best police service in the world. We have the best police service in the world, but the way this government is going, they're trying to destroy it.
I'm going to have to say, though, that there's been some problems at the Metropolitan Police, hasn't there? I mean, it does look as if, you know, there's been collusion between journalists at the News of the World and police, and we've seen quite a lot of quite high-profile resignations, particularly within the anti-terrorist branch.
I think whatever happens, and you know as well as I do, that there will always be one or two bad eggs in various organisations, whether it be the police service, the armed forces, private sector. You will always get that happening somewhere, but they are very, very, very low numbers. And it, you know, it comes down to, and I heard earlier in your show about the media. The media are very powerful, and the media at this moment are being run by the government, and we know it.
Okay, finally then, there's been a sort of part privatisation a few years ago of a large part of Avon and Somerset's police civilian support services, along with parts of North Somerset Council. This was something called Southwest One, in partnership with the big computer giant IBM. What's some of the issues that have come up over the last few years with that, Kevin?
I think certainly there's been a number of issues with regards to staff. There's been a number of issues with regards to computer programming and various things like that.
I mean, has it worked is what I'm ultimately saying. Has it been a positive move forward?
I would say it is moving forward.
Because, I mean, one of the things we had quite a lot of news stories about this, something called the SAPS system. Can you just explain what that is?
Yeah, the SAP basically records everything to do with police officers, to do with their hours, the salary, everything that goes with that.
So it's a sort of computer-based kind of bit of a bureaucratic system that talks about, so where you're registering, what hours you've done, all this kind of thing.
That's correct, yes. There has been problems with it. The force quite openly acknowledged that there's been problems with it. IBM openly acknowledge that there's been problems with it. We keep being assured that they are working to sort it out.
So it hasn't been sorted out still.
They're working on it.
They are still working on it. Okay. Well, look, Kevin Phillips from the Avon and Somerset Police Federation, thanks very much for joining us on Drive Time.
Thank you very much.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Oh, where have you been, my blue-eyed son? And where have you been, my darling young one? I've stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains. I've walked and I crawled on 6 crooked highways. I've stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. And it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard rains are gonna fall. Oh, what did you see, my blue-eyed son? And what did you see, my darling young one? I saw a newborn baby with wild wolves all around it. I saw highway diamonds with nobody on it. I saw a black branch with blood that kept dripping. I saw a room full of men with their hammers a-bleeding. I saw a white ladder all covered with water. I saw 10,000 talkers whose tongues were all broken. I saw guns and sharp swords in the hands of young children. And it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, and it's a hard rains are gonna fall. Oh, what did you hear, my blue-eyed son? And what did you hear, my darling young one? Heard the sound of a thunder that roared out a warning. Heard the roar of a wave that could drown the whole world. I heard 100 drummers whose hands were ablazing. I heard 10,000 whispering and nobody listening. I heard one person starve, I heard many people laughing. I heard the song of a poet who died in the gutter. I heard the sound of a clown who cried in the alley. And it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard rains are gonna fall. Oh, what did you meet, my blue-eyed son? And who did you meet, my darling young one? I met a young child beside a dead pony. I met a white man who walked a black dog. I met a young woman whose body was burning. I met a young girl, she gave me a rainbow. I met one man who was wounded in love. I met another man who was wounded in hatred.
Well, that's really the first part of that particular song, A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, from Bob Dylan's freewheeling album, and it goes on and on and on. But we're going to break into it now because Claire Humphreys is here from Local Schools for Local Children. She lives in Montpellier. Hi, Claire. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hi.
Now, first of all, what's your situation? You just managed to get a child into a junior school?
My son started in reception last September. We didn't get any of our three choices, and we were offered another school, and which he is loving, but it is sort of further away and outside our community. And
well, why is that then? Because I mean, you would have thought that it would be obvious that wherever you live, your local, the nearest school to you, should be the, or one or two anyway, would be the ones that you would get into.
They're all full up. They're all full up. And I live in Montpellier, and the Local Schools for Local Kids represents Montpellier and St Werburgh's, and both of those areas have just single form entry schools.
So what does that mean, single form? That means one class.
Yeah, one class entry. And you know, in the case of St Barnabas on the Montpellier St Paul's border, it's just 24 children, or was it 26 children, that it takes in reception. And last year, both schools only took 7 non-siblings in the reception class. So for St Werburgh's, that meant you had to be living within 200 metres of the school. For St Barnabas, you had to be living 200 metres from the school, the same. But this year, we haven't had the results. We'll hear on Monday, but we believe that it's just as bad this year.
Well, it sounds to me, actually, as if the system isn't really working anymore. If you're talking about a 200-yard catchment area, that's really virtually nothing.
It's virtually nothing. And people will move to an area, and they won't be thinking, when they sort of buy a house, they won't be thinking... They'll be thinking there's a school there. They won't be thinking, oh, that school's so full up, you know. And by the time they have children, we've got people in St Werburgh's who've contacted the group, quite concerned, and they are now moving out of the area because they've got 3-year-olds, and they're looking at the school situation and going, I'm not going to get into that school, I'm not going to get into this school, where am I going to get into? And all the other locals' kids in the area are going to these schools, and there's just sort of black holes around them where they're just going, you don't know what to do.
Martin Summers, we are in a bit of a crazy situation here, aren't we? Because it sounds, from what Claire's saying, the old system, which where schools had a sensible catchment area of a mile or so, is just breaking down.
Well, it's the whole thing about choice, isn't it? When I went to school in witness in Lancashire in the 1960s, we walked to school, to our local school. Yeah. And, you know, there was a fair cross-section of kids there, some nicer than others, but we all walked to the school and we all had to get on because we all lived in the area and we all played together, we all knew each other, and that's how it was. And there was a bit of a difference because there was Church of England schools and Catholic schools, because this is near Liverpool. But, I mean, what's happened now in cities like Bristol with the so-called choice is it's become a complete lottery who goes where. And, you know, people have been bussed from across, you know, people can go. I mean, I would like to ask a question. How many people from outside this local catchment area are in these schools? Is it really just a very tight local catchment area? Or have they got people who've got on the list because they are siblings or because they've got a church background or whatever, you know?
I wouldn't know the figures. I mean, there are a lot of siblings for some of the families, and the schools didn't, like, the two schools didn't used to be so popular. I mean, there are more and more people living in central Bristol,
yeah,
and they really like the lifestyle, and there are a lot less people sending them to private school, say, because, one, the schools have improved, and also they haven't got the money because we've got a recession going
on. But it does sound a little bit perverse that people now have really got to, I mean, maybe even completely base where they live on being, so, you know, within 100 yards or whatever of a particular school.
Prices. Yeah, but when you've got a good school that people want to go to, that will affect the house prices of people moving into the area. I mean, in the past, you know, the aspiration was that all schools would be local schools and they'd all be good. I mean, I went to a primary school in a rural area, and that was fantastic as well because it was very small, there was only 60 kids. And again, everybody knew everybody, everybody went to the same school. I went to Leinster Minster School. Again, that was a secondary school, but it was the only one in the area. Everybody went to it. And everybody got on with everybody else. But of course, in cities like Bristol, you've got all this. Oh well, I've got, there's this school and that school, and there's all this choice sort of agenda going on, which is perfectly good for the private sector. But the state sector has got to be based on, you know, a basic standard for everybody wherever they live.
So Claire, as a frontline mum, so to speak, how do you think the system should be changed? Is it just simply about expanding existing schools to allow bigger intakes?
Well, the trouble is at the moment is we just find it, there's a lot of secrecy about the way that schools seem to be planned. Yes, bigger intakes, possibly.
Well, what do you mean by secrecy?
Well, we don't, the group's been around for a year, and it's really hard to kind of get an idea of what they're planning to do for the area. And if we knew, then we could reassure parents in the area that they don't need to move out to Somerset or Gloucestershire. You know, they could stay in Bristol and be part of the community they love and go to local schools. But we have been given reasons why the two schools, the St Barnabas and St Werburgh's, can't expand, one because it's near a train line and one because of water board or something, but we've also got sitting on our doorstep the old Fairfield school, the old Fairfield Grammar School, which is being used for a pupil referral unit, and at the end of the day all the kids are taxied away to their homes wherever in the city, and that's just a school that's sitting there empty and just.
So Fairfield School, I can remember that, walking past it, what, sort of 5-6 years ago, and seeing brambles and things growing around the place.
Yep.
So it's being rather neglected. So what explanation has been given as to, since there's such a massive demand for reception age places in the area, from the council, from the owners, as to why it's just been essentially mothballed? I mean, I know it's been used for other purposes, but, you know, it should be surely used for the purpose it was built, which is as a school.
It should be, yes, it most definitely should be.
So what have they said about why they haven't?
They said, well, the trouble is you can only set up a new school if it's a satellite school, a free school, or an academy. And
okay, what's a satellite school? Not up in outer space or something?
With another school in the area.
Okay.
So I don't know if they just haven't found a school willing to take it on as a satellite school, but they also keep going, oh, grumble, grumble, it will cost $6 million to build a new school. Well, actually, 2 years ago, that figure was $2 million, so they just seem to be making up figures. And the academies. We've just had an academy open up in Montpellier. We've got the new Colston Girls' School, but that's set a catchment area that's excluded most of Montpellier, so that's not gone.
Well, that's desperately unfair, because that was a private school, and it's basically being funded by the taxpayer now, and the parents don't have to pay any fees, but they've not changed their intake at all.
So are you saying that the catchment areas can be just simply in the academies, just simply set by the academies themselves? Because that's quite important. If it's getting public funding, surely, you know, it's down to the local authority.
Local education authorities used to have an overall planning perspective on these things. Mm. But once you actually break it into bits and you say there's an academy here, a free school there, they are not answerable to anybody other than the people who are running, the governors and so on. And local people can complain, but that you are effectively dealing with a private institution, yes, which doesn't have to take any notice of what you say at all. Mm. They may choose to, they may choose not to. And of course, inevitably, what starts to happen is that the system fragments out, and you know, those who are lucky get the lucky breaks, and those who don't get the bad breaks. And of course, the kids who really suffer there are the ones without articulate parents who've got the sharp elbows to force them in or whatever, because they're the ones who will get pushed to the schools that nobody wants to go to, and that's just no good. We've got to have a standard for everybody, and you know, the model that they're using is the model of private schools in which they themselves were educated, which compete for each other. You know, Nick Clegg went to Westminster, and the Prime Minister went to Eton. But a state school system has to be of a standard for everybody. And if it's not up to standard, things have to be made, efforts have to be made to bring it up to standard. But you've got to have a plan.
Martin seems to be implying that there's a sort of market growing in schools now. Is that how you feel as a mum?
I think that's how most parents are feeling at the moment. I mean, not only does... it doesn't stop. A free school could be set up opposite a very successful school in an oversubscribed area and then draw pupils away from that. And what does that really... Well, I mean, if it's an oversubscribed school, but then that creates extra places there. But it just creates this. It's not about putting it where the places are needed. It's just creating a skew. And most parents that I've chatted to have no interest in setting up something like a free school anyway, because there's a lot of energy that sets up these schools from usually a couple of really dynamic people. And what happens when they've sort of got their eye on the next project and the sort of enthusiasm falls away? Who's there to kind of catch?
Also think of the divisions. I mean, certainly in secondary education, the kind of divisions that can develop between the kids who went to the free school and the kids who went to the Islamic school.
But I mean, isn't that going to
the ordinary
Martin,
school? And of course, they meet at bus stops and fight with each other and so on.
Yes, but
it's
hang
crazy.
On, that happens with all different sorts of schools. You'll get divisions between, I'm from this
not
school, you're from that school.
If you've got an overall plan, for example, you could have a shared sports facility that they all use.
Yeah.
Which isn't just belonging to the City Academy, but is open to everybody on a first-come, first-served basis. But, of course, there's no incentive to do that if the City Academy here, for example, wants to push up its scores in sport or whatever. They don't want to share their facilities with other people.
So Claire, if you were Director of Education in the City, I always like asking these sorts of questions to people. If you could just pull a few levers, what would you like to see happen?
I would like to see... I'd like to see the old Fairfield School reopened, which is what we'd really like to see.
For infants, presumably.
For infants, yeah. It doesn't really have enough space for secondary schools. No, we just want to see... We want to see... You've got Bristol City Council that's supposed to be pushing the green agenda. I personally didn't choose a school that I knew I could get into last year because I didn't want to drive to work. I cycle to work at the moment. I love cycling to work. I don't want to start having to move around my kids by car, driving them places, and local schools is, you know, the benefit of walking to school and the you know, messing around in the playground afterwards and the local parks, it's great. This is good stuff. This is what, you know, kids should be doing, not being driven everywhere and sent miles away. Yeah, so reopen Fairfield, that's what we'd like.
Okay, and not these the academies and the free schools. You don't think those are particularly the way to go, and why is that?
No, well, I suppose I don't know a huge amount about the academies programme, only what I see, which is our local school, well, the new academy near us is the new primary school, the Dolphin School, as part of the Colston Girls' School. And they've set a catchment area that excludes... what blatantly looks like they're social engineering. They're excluding anything that looks like it might have a council tenant in it. It's
In Bristol, the social apartheid is to do with how far up the hill you live, don't you? If you're living in East Bristol, down at sea level, then you're one kind of person. Then you move up the hill to the sort of BBC people at Cotton, Grammar School level. Then you've got Clifton College at the top, where those people go.
We shouldn't be encouraging this kind of segregation.
Absolutely not.
We should be encouraging, you know, collaboration between schools and.
So local schools for local children, how do people find it? Whereabouts are you? Are you online?
We
are you actually?
We have a Facebook page, Local Schools for Local Kids. And we also have a Hotmail you can contact on ls4lk at hotmail.co.uk.
Okay.
And we're having a meeting on the 2nd of May at the Miners Arms. Probably be in the upstairs room.
That's in Minor Road in St
Werburgh. So any concerned parents in St Werburgh or Montpellier can come along.
Okay, and I'll put a link to that up on the webpage of this show when we're finished. Well, Claire Humphreys from Local Schools for Local Children, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM. Clail there and U Sound System. And I'm joined now by Black Avon and Somerset, former Avon and Somerset police officer turned driving instructor Phil Mattis. Hi Phil, welcome to Drive Time.
Thank you very much, Tony.
Now, you have written a book about the state of the family in 21st century Bristol. What caused you to write the book?
Well, it's the tragic circumstances of my own life, really, which propelled me to write it. I was so shocked and bewildered, as I said in my book, by the state of affairs in this country in relation to families, that I felt compelled to do something in my own power about
it. So what's the problem with the family? I mean, most of us have got a family, one sort or another.
Yeah, most of us got a family, but most of it is, I think I'm correct in saying that most families are torn apart, and a significant minority of families, I think, are now single parents. So we've turned away from marriage, we've turned away from what God has ordained, and we've turned to our own ways, and we're reaping disasters as a result.
Okay, well, look, before we get into that, just tell us about your experience as a police officer. Because you were recruited when into the police?
In 1986.
So maybe part of the recruitment drive by the Thatcher government we were talking about earlier, Martin.
Well, maybe it was a bit late for that because they recruited most of them in the early 80s, but yeah.
Okay, and what were your experiences that you'd like to talk about?
Well, most of it was good. I mustn't knock them too much. Most of it was good. Most of my colleagues were fine. We got along very well. But they were a significant minority who were determined to get rid of me, come what come may. And they made their feelings known in the dark recesses of the police station at night, where the ugly side of them came out. And I found it a bit shocking, though I knew it existed, but actually experiencing it for yourself is an eye-opener.
Now, did you feel able to stand up to that? Sounds like bullying to me.
It was bullying. I wasn't able to stand up to it. I was overwhelmed with the level of support for what they were doing, and I was on my own. And at the end of my tenure, when I decided to resign, I complained about it, but everything was whitewashed and nothing came of it.
Well, I think there's also many, many people out there who would agree that the police complaint system generally doesn't work very well.
No.
Ultimately, though, what was the experience that made you decide that you couldn't stay?
The experience, well, my sergeant, who was responsible for my probation, he told me in uncertain terms while in the station one night, I should go and clean the SHIT in the toilet. And I found out, why is he asking me to do that? I'm an officer, not a cleaner. And that's what he thought of me as a black person, that what I should be doing.
But he was your boss, basically.
Was my boss, yeah.
Martin, this is a bit worrying, isn't it?
Well, I mean, the guy should be sacked, simple as that.
Yeah.
That's if you've got a serious police force that's serious about doing its job, people coming out with that, we know there are all sorts of opinions in society, and you can have those kind of opinions if you like, but you can't have them as a police officer, and certainly not as a police sergeant.
No.
Okay, let's talk about the book now. What is it that you think that's wrong then with the family? I mean, you're a Bristol resident yourself. Were you born in Bristol?
I was born in Birmingham.
And you came down here. What do you think's the problem with the family then?
Well, the last previous administration encouraged, I think, families to live separately.
You're talking about the Labour government?
Yeah, the Labour government. Encouraged families to become separate.
How did they do that then? Yeah,
very skillful, very cleverly, very deceitfully, I think, by allowing women, if they become single, to have their benefits increase exponentially. See, marriage wasn't supported, and cohabitation wasn't supported that much, financially, or in the tax and credit system, or in the benefit system.
But ultimately, people make their own decisions. They don't just do everything based on money, do they?
No, but money is a big factor. But if you're given a chance or a big windfall, if you become single, most people would jump to it, and that's exactly what has happened.
Okay, so what do you think see as the solution?
We've turned away from God, as simple as that, and gone to our own ways.
Well, a lot of people don't believe in God, Phil.
I know, then that's the problem.
But yes, but I mean, that's up to the individual. I mean, you're not going to go around forcing people.
No,
I'm
not going to force people, but they got to realise if you turn away from God, you're going to end up with disaster on your hand. And this country, as far as I know, will no longer prosper as a result of turning away from God. We'll just reap what we've sown, basically.
Martin, what about what's your view on this? Because I know you're not a great believer in this kind of thing.
Well, I mean,
necessarily. The family is clearly an important institution.
The family is a clearly important institution, but there's a lot of guys I know, for example, they've got baby mothers, so they've got three or four women who they've got children with. Now, perhaps they shouldn't have done that, but the kids are there now, and the situation is as it is. And in some cases, these guys are such nasty fellas that the women are better off without them, to be honest. And I don't think you can have a hard and fast rule about whether lots of kids are growing up in non-normal situations, you know, but it's not the kids' fault. And you can't wave a magic wand and make the clock go back. And of course, it was slavery in the first place in Jamaica that created the whole business of families being broken up and so on and so forth. And it's become part of, I mean, we're generalising here, obviously, because there's a huge spectrum of different people. But, you know, the problem in the black community of, you know, single parent families. And it's a lot to do with the attitudes of the blokes and the guys, you know. They go out and have children and they just think it's somebody else will look after them. And that's irresponsible of them. But once the kids are born, the kids do deserve support and treasuring by the whole society, including their immediate families, you know. And you can't just solve it by waving a magic wand.
That's part of the problem in this country. We've placed all the blame on the blokes, on the male, on the fathers, and that's not the right way forward. It takes two to tango, and the fault lies equally on both sides.
That's fair enough.
So if you're going to put the blame on one side, you're going to have trouble, you're going to have disaster on your hands. And that's why many teenage boys have rebelled against society, which is part of the reason we have the recent summer riots in Britain.
Well, I mean, that's an interesting one, isn't it? Especially as a former serving police officer. I mean, we do see semi-criminal activity right at the very top of our society with the bankers, with the City of London, these kinds of people. In a way, they're not really setting a very good example. Would you say, how do young people now find role models, Phil?
It's difficult. Young people these days, as was revealed in the riots last year, are very frustrated, extremely frustrated, because they're paying the cost, they're paying the price for the mistakes of their parents and their grandparents. And things don't look like getting any brighter for them in the near future.
Well, come on. There must be a bit of light at the end of the tunnel.
Well, you want me to be honest? There won't be a light at the end of the tunnel until Christ comes back, because we've all turned to our own ways.
Well, surely people can also themselves now sort their situations out, can't they?
You can sort the situation out, but you have to turn to the Book of Wisdom, which is the Bible. And many of us throw the Bible in the bin, or it's growing dust by the side of the bin. We don't care anything about God and expect better from what we're doing. You can't get better if you turn away from God. But most people would disagree with me, but that's the fact. That's the truth.
But what if you're not a believer in the Bible? Surely you can also sort your family out and sort your personal situation out. You don't just have to use the Bible.
Well, if you go by history, if you go by what history has shown, you'll get an answer for yourself. You won't be able to sort it out without the wisdom of God.
Because we got this thing, what was called the credit crunch, it's now called the financial crisis.
Yeah.
This is likely to make things worse, Phil, isn't it?
It's going to make things worse. And it's only a matter of time before this country will not be able to pay its debts anymore, because the debt crisis is spiraling out of control.
Martin, would you agree with that?
Yeah, and it's not just this country. I mean, it's a global problem.
It's a global problem.
You know, Jamaica has struggled with debt repayment for years. You know, they got into debt in the 70s, and they're constantly on a treadmill trying to pay it off. And that means they've got no funds for police officers, no funds for schools, and so on. And I would agree with you that churches, in particular, can play an enormously influential role in binding communities together.
Yeah.
And I saw, for example, the Seventh-day Adventist Church, people I know in Stokes Croft. I mean, they go out and look after homeless people. They don't just walk by them on the side of the road. Mm.
Okay, guys, that's all we've got time for. But, Phil, your book is called British Families Under Labour, and you can get it where?